You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On the morning of March 14, 2012, executives at Goldman Sachs awoke to find that one of the firm's vice presidents had submitted his resignation in an op-ed piece in the New York Times. They, along with millions around the world, read his charges that the company had seriously lost its way. Greg Smith, the author of the op-ed, has now published a book about what he saw as a cultural deterioration at the firm. It's called Why I Left Goldman Sachs, A Wall Street Story. It's published by Grand Central. I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Smith to our show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So when did it become clear to you that you needed to leave Goldman Sachs?
So I think in the crisis, you know, Goldman obviously emerges as one of the last players standing, and the SEC brings a civil fraud suit against Goldman in 2010. And, you know, at that point, when Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman's, called in front of Congress, my initial reaction is to defend the firm because Goldman has more lawyers, more compliance people than anyone else. And I think there's a human inclination to give your place, you know, especially a place you've worked your whole career, the benefit of the doubt. But I got to a point where I actually looked at the facts of what had happened, and Goldman ultimately settled the case for $500 million and then embarked on a thing they called the Business Practices Study, which was designed to try to fix these issues of conflict of interest. And I actually wanted to see some real introspection by the firm, but what got me very disillusioned was this idea of saying publicly our clients' interests always come first, but then going back to your desk and seeing people talking about how to overcharge a teacher's pension fund by $2 million on a product, or how to sell someone a product so complex that they don't understand how much money they're paying. And I went through a process of speaking to 9 different Goldman partners over a year about these issues of ethics and culture. And behind closed doors, people recognize there's an issue. And it's not just me saying it. It's the SEC, it's judges criticizing Goldman. And I got to a point where I thought the system was never going to change from within. And I thought I could take a moral stand and try to change it from outside the firm.
And you, by resigning quite publicly, instead of just simply going to management and saying, you know, I think that we're headed in the wrong direction. Did the New York Times express any concerns about running that resignation?
Well, the New York Times did a very thorough job vetting me. And the one story I talk about in the book is they even sent one of their reporters to Goldman Sachs before I left to make sure I was exactly who I said I was and to make sure that I was sincere about what I was saying. And, I think the reporter could tell that this was a place I actually, when John Whitehead was a great leader the firm had, and he went on to Treasury and some other great things. And this idea of saying reputation and clients come first was something I actually tried to practice. And I think, this idea of just throwing that all away was something that got me very disappointed with the firm. And frankly, I'm not against Wall Street or against Goldman. I just want them to become more transparent and do business that doesn't endanger all of society.
What was the morning of March 14th like for you? I'm assuming you'd already cleared out your office.
Yeah, I went in the previous Saturday once the Times had decided to publish the article. And, on the morning, I knew it was going to come out at 7 a.m. London time. And I woke up.
You were living in London at this time?
Yeah, I was living in London and my brother was staying with me at the time. And I got up at 6 a.m. and I wrote a very heartfelt personal email to the 8 most senior bosses that I reported to, including the CEO of Goldman in Europe. And one of the big points I was trying to make to them is I was seeing young people right out of college getting corrupted as they get out of college and, you know, sitting in these sessions of being indoctrinated about culture, but then going back to their desks and seeing people deceived and this idea of betting against clients was something that I said to these managers, you need to try to fix.
But isn't that something you had seen from the start? You interned at Goldman Sachs years before.
Yeah, I mean, I think
Had the culture of the firm changed a lot over the years?
Yeah, I think, you know, factually people ask the question, isn't this the way Wall Street's always been? And the thing I would say to people is when Goldman Sachs was a private company before 1999, its partners had a real vested stake in making sure that it saw customers as someone to partner with as opposed to someone to try to extract wealth out of. And, you know, you if you measure from 2002 to 2007, a lot of things were deregulated, like complex things called derivatives, banks being allowed to bet with their own money. And you saw this evolution from seeing the client as a partner to seeing the client as an adversary that you tried to almost befuddle into doing things they didn't understand. And it's not just me saying this in terms of behavior. If you look at how Goldman Sachs and other banks make money, in 2002, it made about half its money in the original reasons the sector is called finance, which is that it financed things, it raised money. Fast forward to 2007, it's making 80% of its money in trading.
Now, was it worse than some of the other companies? Was Matt Taibbi right in calling it a vampire squid?
You know, a lot of people talk about a really conspiratorial view of five people sitting in a room plotting to destroy, you know, the commodities market. And what I would tell people and your listeners is the problem is a lot more boring than that. It's people who have figured out how to, you know, there's letter of the law and there's spirit of the law. It's people how to push it all the way to the line and push it over that line. And the ironic thing is many people, I'm sure your listeners, ask the question, why has no one gone to jail for what happened during the crisis? And the answer to that is, ironically, a lot of this stuff is still legal. The idea of ripping off a pension fund, there's nothing technically illegal about it because they're considered a sophisticated investor. So just to be clear, I wrote this book about Goldman Sachs because that's where I worked my whole career. But the reason I wrote it was not to talk specifically about Goldman. It was to talk about industry practices that I think people that are not on Wall Street don't understand. So I wanted to explain simply to people this mysterious business. How does it actually work and how do banks make money?
My guest is Greg Smith. He's written a book called Why I Left Goldman Sachs, A Wall Street Story. So the op-ed piece appeared in the Times. What were you getting? You must have got a lot of phone calls, a lot of emails from people at Goldman, from other people. Was it generally positive?
Yeah, it was quite an overwhelming thing. So I did not know what to expect, but I received more than 4,000 calls, emails, text messages, and it started from people in the financial industry who said things like, "We acknowledge this is a problem. Thank you for speaking up, but the system's never going to change. People are too vested in keeping it the way it is." But I would say the majority of the messages I got were actually from people not in the financial industry, people from, frankly, all over the world who are very suspicious about what's going on and like the idea of speaking up and saying you don't think things are going the right way. So I got some very poignant messages from people in the health insurance industry and in other places that said, you know what, in this world, it's nice to speak up when things are wrong. And I think, you know, my generation, I think people have an idealistic sense that even if you're a loyal person, if you see things that are wrong, it's better to speak up and try to change the system rather than to just accept it.
Well, Goldman Sachs lost over $2 billion in shares after your op-ed appeared. Have you ever regretted the public nature of your resignation?
No, I'm actually very proud of it because I think what I wanted to do was spark a debate that, you know, if you had watched the last three presidential debates, you might have the perception that Wall Street's problems are all fixed. But the truth is, and I don't think a lot of people know this, less than one third of the legislation that was passed 2 years ago has been implemented, and the regulators have missed more than three quarters of the deadlines. And
but Dodd-Frank almost feels dead.
Exactly. And Wall Street, and I don't think people know this either, has spent $300 million lobbying against the most stringent laws in Dodd-Frank. So I was actually proud that this op-ed reignited this debate. And I, you know, I'm of Wall Street and I'm a capitalist, but what it's veered into now is not a fair game anymore. It's a rigged game and an uneven playing field. And I don't want Wall Street to, you asked about the $2 billion that Goldman stock lost. I actually want Goldman to get back to a point where it's admired again, as opposed to making its business about deceiving people.
So you were hoping to make a difference at Goldman Sachs?
Absolutely.
Or Wall Street in general?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, before I left, I was not some lone voice who believed this. There's a lot of angst in this world of Wall Street where people are increasingly being asked to make morally dubious decisions in order to succeed in these environments. So my goal, if I could change the system in some small way, would be to actually help all those honest people not be pulled in this direction of making bad decisions.
Well, this morning, Lloyd Blankfein said on CNBC in reference to your book that anything that makes us more introspective and review our processes is better for us. Did you know he was saying that?
No, but I completely agree. And I think the thing that has upset me about Goldman's reaction to this op-ed is, you know, they went on a Muppet hunt trying to find the word Muppet. Now, my thought is the public would be smart enough to know that calling someone a name or, you know, bantering, I mean, that's part of Wall Street, and that's not the problem. The problem is the reason you called them a Muppet, which is that a global philanthropy or a charity or a university endowment got tricked into doing something they didn't understand. And in the book, I talk about a number of situations where a client was overcharged by $1 million because they didn't understand the product. And, you know, I think, and I wish Goldman, instead of denying there's a problem, which a lot of people acknowledge there is, and instead of trying to shoot the messenger, I'd really hoped they would actually address the issues of how are you treating your clients.
But what about the client side? Why would a client buy a product that didn't understand?
There are two reasons. I mean, the one is it's very alluring to trade with the smartest people on Wall Street. And Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and J.P. Morgan will go to clients. And I talk about in the book, you know, a product that I call Clorox, which it's basically a black box. And it's designed by rocket scientists to promise the client, like a philanthropy or a teacher's pension fund, you know, all sorts of good things. But then on page 52 of the disclaimers, you read all the things that could possibly go wrong. And these are the kinds of things like, you know, the Greek government, Goldman Sachs helped trade a derivative earlier in the decade that helped them cover up their debt. Or, you know, Jefferson County in Alabama traded a derivative with J.P. Morgan that backfired and took the county into bankruptcy. And, you know, my argument is these clients, unfortunately, are not on an even playing field with hedge funds. And my hope would be there's more transparency.
And you say that there are four types of clients, so some are more sophisticated than others.
Absolutely. And when, you know, Lloyd Blankfein was called in front of Congress, Carl Levin asked a lot of questions about the SEC lawsuit. And his argument and other Wall Street CEOs' argument is, you know, everyone's on an even playing field. Now, what I talk about in the book is I try to show people how hedge funds are far more sophisticated than a person who is managing a $1 billion police retirement fund. And, you know, obviously it's incumbent on those clients to educate themselves. But my argument would be if things are more transparent and not in the dark and not deregulated, they would actually be able to make smarter decisions. And I would say people should know how closely this affects them and should lobby their politicians to actually increase transparency.
Well, you were working at Goldman before the financial crisis of 2008 and after it. Did that have an impact on the way Goldman dealt with its clients?
It did. And I think what happens is, you know, as you know, just to take your listeners through the history, in 1999, Glass-Steagall gets repealed, which allows banks to become more risky in how they bet with their own money. In 2000, derivatives get deregulated. And then in 2004, banks start getting allowed to take huge leverage with their money. And it leads to this environment where banks see we can actually make a lot more money by using our clients' information to make our own bets as opposed to facilitating the client's business. And I think that's the big shift that occurred into the crisis and, frankly, is still in place today and how Wall Street banks make most of their money today.
So it's really these companies are more interested in their own survival than in helping their clients.
Exactly right. And my view would be—
Because some did go under.
Yes, they went under. And, you know, people ask the question, why do people still do business with these firms? And it's exactly for that reason. Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, they've all disappeared. And my argument would be if Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley or J.P. Morgan want to be a hedge fund and bet with their own money, they should just say, you know what, we're now a hedge fund. But then they should stop taking government support and they should stop having this mantra of our clients' interests always come first, because I think it's just deceptive to people who come to Goldman for advice not to be ripped off.
My guest is Greg Smith. His book, Why I Left Goldman Sachs, A Wall Street Story, is published by Grand Central Publishing. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Greg Smith, who resigned from Goldman Sachs in the spring of 2012. He was the head of Goldman Sachs' United States equity derivatives business in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. And he has written a book called Why I Left Goldman Sachs, A Wall Street Story. It's published by Grand Central Publishing. Now, your accent reveals that you were, you're from South Africa. Where did you go to school?
So I've been in America for about 15 years. So people here think I still have a South African accent, but my friends back in South Africa think I have an extreme American accent. And I've, you know, in South Africa, we don't say math. We say maths with an S on the end.
And, in Britain, too.
Yeah, in Britain, too. So I have a bit of a hybrid accent. But I grew up in Johannesburg, and I left South Africa when I was 18. I was very fortunate to get a scholarship to go to Stanford, and me and my best friend actually got the same scholarship, and we it was my first time going to America. So I left in 1997 to go to Palo Alto.
And you began interning while you were in school? At Goldman?
Yeah. So my sophomore year, I had an internship in Chicago at a firm which used to be called Payne Webber. And then my junior year, I got an internship at Goldman Sachs. And it was a very, very proud moment for me.
And you compare getting a full-time job as an intern to the reality show Survivor.
Yeah.
Is that kind of level of competition actually necessary?
You know, it's to get a job at Goldman Sachs, I think – you know, I reference in the book, there's some kind of statistic like 1 in 45 people who applies gets a job. And it's exactly like that Survivor thing, because even once you get there, only 40% of the interns get a full-time job. And then every 2 years, there's a culling process. So once you're an analyst, I'd say only about half of the people get promoted to associate and then to vice president. And, you know, by the time I left, out of the 75 people that were in my intern class, there were only 7 of us left.
So you must have been proud of this opportunity. Did you see any warning signs?
I was very proud. And in fact, I used to lead our recruiting at Stanford. I would fly out twice a year. And I was very proud to look kids in the eye and say, you know, these things we talk about teamwork and integrity, these things are real. I even appeared on a recruiting video for Goldman. They asked me to appear in one that was played on every college campus. But the truth is, there were signs. And I try to show this in the book that, you know, early in the 2000s, there Lloyd Blankfein, who was number two at the company, and Hank Paulson, who was running the company, they started talking about conflicts of interest. And it started out almost as a positive thing that we were embracing. And in fact, Lloyd and Hank Paulson wrote a letter to shareholders saying, you know, Goldman Sachs has figured out how to walk this fine line where we can advise clients, we can trade with clients, we can co-invest with them. And you know, early on in my career, there was a deal where Goldman Sachs advised both parties who were merging. It was the New York Stock Exchange and Archipelago. And the CEO of the New York Stock Exchange was John Thain, who was the former president of Goldman Sachs. And, you know, at the time, this was something that Goldman Sachs was very proud of, because they thought, you know, we've figured out how to walk this fine line. And frankly, people within the firm were very proud that we've almost charted new territory. But the truth is, you fast forward 5 years later and you see that these conflicts of interest just started getting more and more exploited over time.
So many former Goldman Sachs employees wound up working in government.
Yeah. And even today, look at, you know, Arthur Levitt, the former chairman of the SEC, now works for Goldman Sachs. And Goldman Sachs' new press secretary used to be Tim Geithner, the secretary treasury's aide. So the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington, in my opinion, is a huge problem because prevents politicians from being objective.
In 2010, the SEC sued Fabrice Touré and Goldman Sachs for securities fraud because of their role in creating abacus deals. What are abacus deals?
So abacus deals was, it's basically a sausage that was stuffed with mortgages. And the issue that the SEC raised was the fact that that security was actually created by a hedge fund in order to fail. The hedge fund was Paulson and Company, and that hedge fund ended up making $1 billion on the trade. At the same time, Goldman salespeople were going to big institutional investors and saying to them, this is a great security, you should take the other side of it.
Now, knowing that it was structured to fail?
Absolutely knowing that a hedge fund had designed it with the view that it was going to fail. Now, obviously, no one knew exactly what was going to happen to the mortgage market, but the problem is that in another room, Goldman Sachs itself had a huge bet on mortgages in a short direction, meaning they were betting it was going to go down. So in my mind, you need to lay your cards on the table. And if you're recommending something to a client, whereas in another room you're betting against that exact deal, I think the problem a lot of people in the country had with it is it's just very deceptive because it's not an even playing field. And I think a free market, everyone has to have a fair shot at winning.
How did Abacus make you feel about your company?
I mean, I talk about a story in the book right after Abacus and Goldman was sued. I actually fly to Asia to meet with one of the firm's biggest clients to almost calm them down. And I go into the meeting with one of the biggest funds in the world, and I'm sitting there with the Goldman Sachs partner as well. And the client looks us in the eye and says, "Let me be very honest with you guys. We do not trust you at all." But
he said he hadn't trusted you for years.
Yeah, hadn't trusted you for years, believed we were a hedge fund, and said, "You don't need to worry. We're still going to do business with you because you're the smartest on the street and we feel we have to." Now, my reaction, you know, my jaw almost dropped because a company where you work your whole career to build trust with a client and they're telling you openly to your face they don't trust you is a bad thing. Now, I leave the meeting and the Goldman Sachs partner is jubilant about this. He says to me, "This is great news. They're not going to cut off their business." Whereas my reaction is, if you're a steward of the firm and you actually have the long-run interests of the firm at heart, you should have been distraught at this news. When one of the biggest sovereign funds in the world is telling you to your face they don't trust you, that's a terrible thing and something you should try to fix.
People would like to think that in the wake of the crisis, Wall Street has changed its ways, but you seem to be saying the opposite. Is it really just that Wall Street is looking for ways to survive without creating too many more scandals?
I'm exactly saying the opposite. And I'll tell you three things that I don't think people generally know. The one is that the five biggest banks in the country that are considered too big to fail are actually bigger now than they were before the crisis. The other point is that legislation that was supposedly going to be landmark reform has not been implemented, and Wall Street has lobbied against it. And I think banks, because politicians are funded by the banks, there's not a lot of political will to actually fix this problem. And things like betting against clients or trading complex securities called derivatives, these things are going on unabated. And I would recommend people speak up and try to fix it.
During the crisis, you had a conversation with a colleague who said that he would encourage his children to go into the sciences.
Yeah.
Rather than into the financial industry.
Yeah, I mean,
but people went to the financial industry because you could make so much money.
Yeah, I tell that story. I was on a subway, and it was a couple of weeks after Lehman Brothers had gone bankrupt, where there was really a sense like the whole industry was going to go down, and it was one of those moments where, you see on TV when people are on a plane that's about to go down, and they literally speak unfiltered truth. And this was a senior managing director who said to me, "You know what? We don't actually make a product. Like, what is our value to the system?" And he said to me, "I'm going to advise my kids to go into the sciences," because I think there's a recognition on Wall Street that there's almost a bubble where, let's say Wall Street all ended, people making $2 million, $5 million today, the next job they went to, they have no skill set and they're probably going to be making $100,000.
So did all of this disillusion you? You kept on working there. And then you were transferred to the London office. In 2011, was London similar to New York?
London was different in that people were a lot more callous about talking about ripping off clients. And I talk about this idea of making fun of clients that don't understand things. And a lot of the time, these clients were called Muppets, which in the UK is a term, a derogatory term for someone who doesn't exactly know what they're doing and whose strings you can pull. The thing that continually disillusioned me was not the idea of calling someone a name, which everyone on Wall Street does. It's part of the culture. It's the idea of we're saying something publicly, and the hypocrisy of that when you actually see people doing something completely different privately. And a lot of the time, and another thing I think people don't know is hedge funds, which are rich people, account for less than 5% of the market. The real big players are pension funds and mutual funds that hold people's retirement savings. And the idea of making a business on deceiving those investors, it was something that no longer jived with my value system. And ultimately, I had to leave. But certainly, I could have woken up earlier. And I was absolutely idealistic and tried to give the place the benefit of the doubt. But I thought it was better to say something now than not say something at all.
You quote Goldman Sachs' second business principle that our assets are our people, capital, and reputation. If any of these is ever diminished, the last is the most difficult to restore. You see that as just hypocritical at this point? At one point, hadn't that been a guiding principle?
It definitely had, and I talk about after September 11th, Goldman's mentality was, let's try to help investors get back on their feet. And then you flash forward to the crisis, and a very senior partner at the firm started telling people, you know what, if I have to choose between my profit and loss, meaning how much money I make, or my reputation, I choose my profit and loss because I can always regain my reputation, whereas if I lose $10 billion, I can't regain that. And my thought was, you know what, then we shouldn't be holding to these business principles anymore. We should just abolish them and say, you know what, this is a buyer beware business. When you come to us, you should expect we could be covering up our interests or we could be trying to take advantage of it, and you should have your eyes wide open.
And after you moved to London, you found that the firm was refusing to do business with some clients. Why?
Yeah, well, so this is part of the thing. So Goldman Sachs asked me to move to Europe to build up a U.S. practice in Europe. And I would fly from Germany to Switzerland to France to Italy, and I would meet with investors. And over and over and over again, they would say to me, we don't trust Goldman Sachs, and you're frankly turning down our business and telling us it's not profitable enough for you. Now, I would go back to headquarters in London, and I would meet with senior partners, and I would say to them, look, even if this is not the most profitable business, if we want to repair our reputation with clients, we actually have to fix this problem and do their business. And you know, a term I talk about in the book is called an elephant trade, which is a trade that makes Goldman Sachs $1 million or more in one shot. And the mentality today is all about elephant trades. It's only about finding the least sophisticated investor to trade the most complex product that'll make the firm money very quickly.
And you took issue with the emphasis placed on gross credit and axes. What are those practices, and why did they bother you?
So an axe is a term used on Wall Street, and I give the idea of it's a stupid analogy, but I talk a little bit about, let's say you were running a Krispy Kreme donut shop and you had too much inventory and suddenly you wanted to get rid of all your inventory before the product went stale. You could come up with some kind of advertising campaign that said, now our donuts are fat-free. And even though that would actually be a lie, people would come in and think, you know what, Krispy Kreme's a pretty credible brand. We're going to buy this product. That is what an axe is. It's when a Wall Street bank really wants to get rid of something and spins a tale that is not true and is not accurate to what the firm really believes.
So Goldman can create volatility in the market according to what stocks it wants to get rid of?
Yeah, and you know, one of the last straws for me was last summer, where your listeners will know, you know, Europe is in a tumultuous situation. Greece, Spain, Italy are all teetering on serious financial problems. And I would go to our morning meeting, and every 2 days, our trading desk would change their viewpoint on the European situation purely to drum up new business. And I started thinking to myself, if we're having this impact on these European banks moving up and down 10% every day, this is not some intangible asset. These are real people's lives that are being impacted by spinning a story to drum up business. So I started seeing it as being highly irresponsible and reckless.
My guest is Greg Smith. His book, Why I Left Goldman Sachs, A Wall Street Story. During a town hall meeting in London with all of Europe's offices, one woman asked what the firm planned to do about the deterioration of the firm's culture and reputation. How did management respond?
So these meetings are held every few months, and it was the two CEOs of Europe standing on the stage, and frankly, it was almost like something out of a movie where people were just flabbergasted, number one, that a woman would have the audacity to ask this question, but number two, at how stunned the two leaders were that someone would have the audacity to ask the question. And the truth is, I spoke to dozens of people before I left who feel the same way, that we were once proud of Goldman Sachs, and it literally threw away the reputation it took a long time to build. But unfortunately, the managers on stage did not have a good answer. They just said, look, we've done an assessment and we've got to follow those. And they also said, we're family people and we need to stick to those values. And it did not show me a lot of introspection.
Well, you suggested earlier that a change occurred when it went from being a private firm to a public firm, because at that point, every company has to worry about the people who are buying their stocks, and they want to be as profitable as possible to keep the stock prices up, especially when executives are often their salaries are tied in with the cost of the stock.
And I think that's the way businesses should operate, but it's not operating like that today, and I'll tell you why. Like, if you look at Goldman Sachs stock when it went public in 1999 and you compare the price to where it is today, it's almost at the same level. So over a 12-year period, more than $100 billion of bonuses have been extracted out of the company, and more than half of the revenues are paid out in compensation, yet the shareholders don't have much to show for it. And the last thing I would say, and this is a little bit technical, is if you look at how stockholders are valuing the banks today, the market is valuing them at below liquidation value, which tells you even stockholders don't like the business model. So what I'm advocating for and what I talk about in the book is a model where you bring back more of a fiduciary duty to do right by clients, you make money more slowly and transparently, and shareholders will actually value your stock more highly, in my opinion.
Now, Goldman suggested after your resignation that you had asked for a raise and promotion shortly before you resigned.
So on Wall Street, you have a mandatory meeting called a compensation meeting, which people in the industry know about. This wasn't some untoward thing that was unusual, where they actually ask you two questions. They say, what do you want to get compensated and what career trajectory goals do you have? So I certainly wasn't going to say to them, well, next year I would like you to demote me and I would like you to pay me less. On Wall Street, if you don't say that you want to be successful and do well, they would hold that against you. But frankly, what's disappointed me a little bit is there's an effort by Goldman to shoot the messenger, and
they're suggesting that if you'd gotten the raise and the promotion, that none of this would have happened.
Well, what I would say to that is, if I was concerned about my own enrichment or wealth, I would have either stayed at Goldman Sachs or I would have left quietly and gone to work at Morgan Stanley or JP Morgan, who are always trying to hire Goldman people. But I walked away from a career in order to say something I believed in, and that was the reason I did it.
Now, do you think that the answer to this lack of morality that you say happens at Goldman Sachs and other financial firms suggests that the government should get more involved? There should be more regulation?
Without doubt. And I think, to give your listeners one recent example, JP Morgan, people will remember, lost $6 billion this past summer on reckless trades. And the CEO gets called in front of Congress, and instead of getting really asked the tough questions, how did this happen? Why did it happen? It was a sense of, well, you're the best in the industry. If this can happen to you, you know, advise us on how to fix it. Now, if your listeners reflect back to the great crash of 1929, there was a thing called the Pecora hearing, where there was real political will to change the system. So what I would say is it's very unfortunate that the top banks like JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs are funding the campaigns of the very people that are supposed to regulate them. So I would say to people, really speak up, and before you vote, recognize this is an issue that affects you directly.
Jamie Dimon, the man you're referring to, people said would have been fired at another time. Instead, here he was being treated as visiting royalty by Congress. Since you left Goldman Sachs in March, you've been writing this book. Now that it's been published, what's next? I doubt anyone in Wall Street will want to hire you.
Well, I think the one thing that people on Wall Street don't realize, and sometimes Wall Street gets caught up in its own bubble. It thinks what it is it's just rich people and five big banks. The truth is, Wall Street has been entrusted with Main Street savings through the mutual funds and pension funds and retirement accounts, trillions of dollars. So I actually think people should know that you need to hold Wall Street to a higher standard. So what I would like to do is I would like to become part of a voice from within the industry, not to make it, not to do anything destructive, but to actually make the model more sustainable, where a JP Morgan can't lose $6 billion because it's just illegal. And on the flip side, doesn't risk dragging all of society into bailing the banks out. And effectively what you have now is the upside is being privatized to an elite few people and the downside is being socialized to everyone. And it's just not a fair system in my mind. So I would like to work to try to change that.
Greg Smith's book is Why I Left Goldman Sachs, A Wall Street Story. It's published by Grand Central Publishing. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.